From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made last week in Washington when a group of high-profile conservatives and Republicans made an announcement that caught, well, some people by surprise. The group declared that it is time for Republicans to get serious about climate change, and they have an idea that could help. As CNN reports, they're calling for a substantial new carbon tax, but not just a tax. They want to return all of the money raised in the tax to American taxpayers. It's a very similar idea to the carbon fee and dividend that we discussed this past fall, which is also being pushed by a former Republican congressman, Bob Inglis. So who is the new group of Republicans pushing for a carbon tax? It includes three former cabinet secretaries, including James Baker. They met last week with President Donald Trump's top economic advisor. But are Republicans in Congress ready to make a deal on a carbon tax and to confront climate science? That is not clear yet at all. Let me welcome my guests for the hour. On the line with us is Peter Brin. He's the conservative director of the Citizens Climate Lobby, an engineer who began his career with ExxonMobil. Peter, thanks for taking the time for the program.
Good morning, Evan. Appreciate you having me on.
And in studio with us, we've got a couple of people who are doing work in our own community. Chris Stearman is doing some work with the Rochester People's Climate Coalition and as the Citizens Climate Lobby liaison in the 27th District, Congressional District. Is that right, Chris?
Yes, that's right.
Well, great to have you. Thank you for being with us here.
Thank you very much.
And Rob Levine is here. Rob got involved with RPCC, right, Rob, about a year ago?
Citizens Climate Lobby.
I get my alphabet soup mixed up here.
There's a lot of confusion.
It's nice to see you here. You were mentioning that you actually were listening to this program and you heard a discussion which sparked your interest. Is that right?
That is correct, yes. Thanks for having us.
Well, here you are. Well, it's great to have you, Rob. So, listeners, what we're going to be talking about this hour are some proposals that are out there that we'll see how much life they have. But I want to start by asking Peter Brin if we're just wasting our time here talking about the word tax in Washington with conservatives. Peter, conservatives in Washington don't have a history of embracing any kind of a tax, right?
Well, yeah, you know, you bring up an excellent point, Evan, which is that, and this was made pretty clear, actually, by the Climate Leadership Council. Now, we should point out that the folks who were in Washington last week promoting this idea are referring to it as carbon dividend plan. It is a slightly different plan than ours, so it is a separate plan, although it's, you know, it has a lot of similarities to what we propose. And they're quick to point out that it, in fact, is not a tax in the sense that it's really what we would like to call the user fee. You know, it's if you want to emit greenhouse gas emissions, that's fine, go ahead. But there's going to be a fee associated with that. And the assumption is that that drives behavior. Now, the reason it's not a tax is because all of those proceeds are returned to households, and it does not go to growing government. So, you know, those who would want to oppose this, obviously, are going to pull out the dirty T word to scare everybody. But the reality is it's not that. And that's an important distinction we make. And even to the point of saying that, you know, a lot of people have expressed concerns about a carbon tax causing negative economic impact. And in fact, they're correct. If you just do a tax and you don't return the money, that would actually be the case. So it is important to distinguish between a tax and a fee the way that has been proposed.
Sure, absolutely. In fact, I want to listen to some of what James Baker told CNN. As we get ready to do that, if you're wondering who's part of this group of conservatives and Republicans that is calling for this fee and dividend, calling for this approach to climate change, obviously James Baker is part of it. And then you've got people like Hank Paulson, who, of course, was Treasury Secretary in the George W. Bush administration, Martin Feldstein, a conservative economist who led President Ronald Reagan's Council of Economic Advisors, Greg Mankiw, who was the CEA chief for George W. Bush, Ted Halstead, founder of the New America Foundation, George Shultz, who led the labor, treasury, and State Departments, as well as serving as director of the Office of Management and Budget. That's the group that is saying it's time to do this. Let's listen to what James Baker told CNN.
How do you convince a president who has said at one point that he thought climate change was a hoax generated by the Chinese?
Well, I'm not sure we do, and we may not. But this is a good plan, both from a policy standpoint and from a political standpoint. It is a problem, right now at least. And Republicans have not been at the table because we've been basically skeptics or deniers. Now, when you have companies like BP and Exxon and Total and Shell all saying we ought to have a carbon tax of some sort, I think we ought to listen to that.
That's James Baker talking to CNN. I want to ask all of our guests what they think. I'll start with Peter Brin here. Is his voice strong enough to get people to listen who are actually in elected office right now, Peter?
That's to be seen. I think that's an interesting question. James Baker is incredibly well-respected amongst Republican establishment, but of course this is an interesting time where the establishment is not certainly the only faction within the party that has a lot of strength. And so, I obviously I'm hopeful. I think the good that could come out of this is obvious. You know, there may be some longtime Republicans who will look at this and consider, folks in my own tribe are starting to come out on this and say that this is an issue. And not only this is an issue, but here's a good conservative way to deal with it. On the flip side, I've made the frog in a boiling pot analogy where, a lot of what Citizens Climate Lobby does is working locally in district behind the scenes, getting things done in Congress, moving things along slowly. We're sort of the organization that's slowly putting a temperature up in the pot of water. When you take folks at the gravitas of Hank Paulson and Jim Baker and others and put them out there in front of the national media, that's sort of throwing the frog into a boiling pot. So I'm wondering if the reaction. I'm still kind of on the lookout for what the reaction will be. So I'm hopeful. I think we have to be careful about how we use this, but I do think there's a huge opportunity here. And to add to that, the council, my understanding is this is what they're calling a phase one. Phase two, they're going to bring out a lot of other folks and, folks who I think maybe, no disrespect to Mr. Baker, but perhaps more relevant today in the sense of current business leaders from around the country whose names carry weight, in more modern times.
Sure. All right, Rob Levine, what do you think of what you heard from James Baker?
Well, I agree that there may be some skepticism with those in government right now, but what we're excited about is that we have Republican leadership taking the cap off the bottle and saying, one, it's okay to talk about climate change, admitting that there's some human element involved in it, and that the risk of not doing anything about it is so great, regardless of the cause, that we need to do something about it, like a carbon fee and dividend. So we're looking locally, and we've seen it in the last 2 months, that a lot more people are interested in our organization because they want to get involved. And so we're kind of hoping we'll see some more conservatives who have maybe felt that climate change is an issue but thought it was taboo to speak about if you're a conservative, who now may say, you know what, it's time to get involved. And that's where we're going to make change.
Ooh. Let's see if we'll reconnect with Peter there. And Rob, let me just follow up on that point. In the last year, part of your work involves getting business leaders involved. What do they typically tell you when you have that first conversation?
It's been very interesting and enlightening. We've met with a lot of business leaders in the last few months who all are behind the concept, but the impetus to take action has been slow. And measured because of, I think, the political climate, and companies are a bit concerned about how they might be viewed. We're hoping this type of activity from the conservative economic standpoint will allow business leaders and community leaders to become more active and not be afraid.
Listeners, I see the phone ringing, and we're going to be taking your calls. If you've got questions about these proposals, carbon fee and dividends, how it would work, all related questions, how to get more people across the aisle. And eventually we're going to keep calling everybody, I guess. But you hear the phone ringing. That's a good thing. 844-295-TALK. It's toll free. 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. Chris Stearman, who works as a liaison for Representative Collins for the Citizens Climate Lobby in Congressional District number 27, what does that entail for you, for your work?
Well, I'm new at this, and so what it means for me is getting, we're getting a chapter going in the 27th District for Citizens Climate Lobby to get people involved, and then meeting with Representative Collins' office to try to find common ground so we can move towards the carbon fee and dividend idea. What I think right now is I'm just really excited that there is something that I think a lot of people have avoided this issue because it just seems too big. And now there's actually something that both sides can work on together and have an impact. And that's, I think, what the difference is. And I think we might get more headway with people that prior to this have kind of avoided the issue.
Chris, I think those who have followed politics in our region might think, well, if you're interested or concerned about climate science, Chris Collins is going to get involved. They may have some skepticism there.
Well, Chris Collins is well known for being a big support of his constituents, agriculture and other things like that. And he does worry. He has had concerns about how climate is affecting or what the changes that are happening in the lakes. So I think by finding national security issues. So because there are connections there, I think that we will be able to have conversations with Representative Collins, whether or not there may be areas that we differ.
All right, before I jump onto your phone calls, Rob, can I get calls in? Is that something should we wait? All right, we're going to wait just for now. So if you're waiting on the phones, hang in there because we're sort of making sure we're all square there. So before I start taking your phone calls, maybe what we can do is also listen to some comments. We also have some comments from Bob Inglis, a former member of Congress. And the reason I want to listen to this comment, I've got a specific question for our panel. If you don't remember the story of Bob Inglis, he was on the program this past fall. He was a member of Congress, in fact, had two separate terms in Congress in South Carolina. He likes to say he was a Republican, a conservative in the reddest district in the country, and that he was a proud conservative. He's not a rhino or any other pejorative that a Republican or a conservative might have. But his kids prevailed upon him to actually take a look at climate science. And what he told us on this program was, what he recalls from the early 2000s was, well, Al Gore says climate science is real, therefore we have to say it's not. And that was about the end of the research he did. Until his kids said, please take a look. He went to Antarctica, and then he met with scientists in Washington, and he came back to his kids and he said, okay, it's real. And then he went to his fellow conservatives in Congress and said, let's do a market-based plan here. Let's get serious about this in a way that is market-oriented. And unfortunately, that led to him being primaried. I say unfortunately for him, led to him being primaried, and he was out of office the next term. And he's been out of office since, but now he is calling on Republicans to do exactly what Peter Brin and this group of Republicans is calling on members of Congress to do now. So this is some of what Bob Inglis had to say about the plan to deal with climate with free enterprise.
I have the wonderful opportunity now to travel the country and tell the champions of free enterprise to overcome their inferiority complex. They apparently think they're no good at energy and climate. And so when the topic comes up, my friends, my conservative friends, the people that I identify with, shrink in science denial because we think we're no good. But actually, we're very good. We're the kid in class who has the answer. Raise your hand. You got the answer. It's free enterprise, and you have known it all along. What it takes is simply this, a true cost comparison between the competing fuels. Put all the cost in, take all the subsidies out, and free enterprise can fix climate change.
That's Bob Inglis from his TEDx talk. You ought to watch it. It's about 18 minutes long, and it is worth a watch from a genuine conservative talking about climate change. But Peter, I'll start with you, and I'll ask all of our panelists this. Here's the common thread between Bob Inglis, James Baker, Greg Mankiw, all of the people who are involved with this current effort. They are former office holders. They are not currently in Congress. They're not currently in the cabinet. And it seems to be a lot easier for conservatives to get more direct about climate science and climate change and fees and dividends when they're out of office. How is that going to change, Peter?
Well, you know, I think we have really good news on this, and that it changed about a little over a year ago. And in fact, it was leaders from right there in New York State who helped create that change. Representative Gibson, who just retired, was the creator of, and I apologize, my phone dropped before, so if this was already ground that we just covered, I apologize.
No, go ahead.
So Congressman Gibson, created what we lovingly called the Gibson Resolution in the last Congress, and that was basically what turned out to be about 13 or 14 Republicans who signed on to this resolution that basically said, yeah, climate change is happening, people are causing it, and Congress should do something about it. Coming out of that was another effort that that is alive and well to this day and has grown considerably, which is the Bipartisan Climate Solutions Caucus. And again, right there in New York State, we have Congressman Stefanik from Northern, for upstate New York, and Congressman Zeldin from Eastern Long Island, Suffolk County, who also sits on that caucus. And that is a, currently it's 12 Republicans, 12 Democrats on that Congress. So, you know, getting back to the sort of the frog in a boiling pot analogy, again, you know, it's all these little baby steps where these members of Congress who really do want to do the right thing, they're there because they believe that, you know, they believe in doing the right thing, they believe in their country, they want to do the right thing by their constituents. They're just looking for a way to do it that won't be politically, you know, troubling for their career. And so they're working, and that's really where Citizens Climate Lobby comes in, trying to build the grassroots support within the district, working with chambers of commerce, working with mayors, working with young Republican groups and things like that, that really are, you know, sort of the core constituency for these members of Congress, to give them that safe passage for them to sort of come out on this. So, you know, in the national eye, it's not obvious, but if you just, you know, start peeling a few layers back, you start to see a lot of movement in Congress, and it's really exciting.
All right, let me turn to our guests in studio, and then we're going to go to the phones because we're all squared up. So thanks for hanging in there on the phones if you're there. Chris Stearman, do you agree with that the key right now is for Republicans in Congress to know that within their district, it is safe for them to be direct and out front about climate science as a Republican, as a conservative, and that part of your work is making sure that they understand that?
No, I think that's a really good point. I mean, we've been working really hard to get awareness amongst the constituency in District 27 so that they can know what's going on, that this, something can be done. But I think, yes, it has been hard for more conservative people to come right out and say what they know is kind of going on, but they don't want to commit political suicide.
Are we that far away from it not being political suicide, do you think?
I really think we're getting there, you know. And on the other hand, I don't know what's going to happen in the future, but what's the alternative? You have to work towards it.
Yeah, Bob Inglis told us on this program, he said there are some big names behind closed doors that would really surprise you, but he couldn't be the one to break news on this program, and they've got to do it themselves. But he doesn't think we're far away either. He was talking about U.S. senators. We shall see. Rob Levine, same kind of question here. You know, do you think that it's about reaching across and using the language that I think conservatives value? It's about accountability, personal accountability, a pro-market solution. It's about American innovation, and in many ways, American exceptionalism, to say that we can be exceptional. We can innovate our way through this.
Absolutely. You know, there was a Yale poll done in the last couple of years that showed that 55% of Republicans think carbon dioxide should be regulated. Over 50% feel that fossil fuel subsidies should be cut. A poll last year said 56% of Trump supporters believe that global warming is real. But there's this, up until now, this kind of fear of being honest about it with their peers. I think where we're at now and what volunteers at Citizens Climate Lobby are trying to do is bring that out. So I've been meeting with members of City Council, Chamber of Commerce, our universities, our healthcare system leaders, and trying to encourage them to get past that border and endorse climate change as real, endorse carbon fee and dividend, and then meet with Louise Slaughter's people and with Chuck Schumer and with Kristen Gillibrand, because we know they support the idea, but they're not taking the steps. You know, Peter alluded to the two New York representatives on the Climate Solutions Caucus. They happen to be Republicans, but there's no Democrats. And to me, that seems to be incongruous with how we think of liberals support climate change and Republicans don't. So we're seeing that there's really the building of hopefully a groundswell of conservatives who will call their, you know, congressmen in Chris Collins' district and say, look, it's something that's happening. I grow grapes and I'm going to have some problems in the future. We need to deal with it. And the market-based solution that's revenue neutral, that's encouraging innovation, that really puts a price on pollution and subsidizes innovation, is where we need to be in the future, because we need a clean economy if we're going to survive into the 21st century.
All right, listeners who've been waiting to jump in, let's go to the phones. Rich in Rochester first up. Go ahead, Rich.
Hey, how you doing, Evan?
Good.
Just a couple of points. It's it's unfortunate that we have to spend 8 years of not dealing with this because of the politics. But another thing, maybe we should talk about, I think the approach of that they're taking of talking about the economic side is important, because it's more about economics, I think, than like, I mean, there's going to be a lot of changes on the earth, but it's really about us and how we handle it. The earth itself will be fine. So I think just that little swing and that paradigm shift and talking about how it economically affects us and how we can economically gain from it, I think is important.
Rich, thanks for the phone call. Peter Brin, what do you make of that?
I couldn't agree more with Rich. I think he's absolutely right. You know, when we communicate this, we look at it as, I look at it a lot as an economic issue. I say, you know, look, you know, oftentimes people say, well, the earth has been hotter. And I say, well, that's true. But we didn't have, you know, 7.5 going on 8 billion people on the planet at that time and trillions of dollars in infrastructure that is at risk from rapid change. And, you know, the other thing that's interesting is that the more I understand climate science, not that I spend a lot of time on the science, frankly, but, you know, just by osmosis, you sort of pick it up. You realize that even absent climate change, I mean, the planet does change a lot on its own, right? There are a lot of natural forces that are changing all the time. And so, you know, you do kind of realize that, you know, but what makes this, so what does make this really spectacular? What makes it a big issue is the rate at which it's happening, and that's really driven by our activities. But, you know, one of the other things that was said earlier was that, you know, asking Republicans to acknowledge the climate science, I don't even think that we have to do that so much. I think James Baker, on that point, I think he said it very well at the press conference last week, where, you know, he said, look, I'm not even 100% sold on the science yet, but it's a risk. You know, it's a risk. And if you have a risk, what do you do with the risk? You manage it. And that's, you know, that's often the comparison. I live down here in Houston, and for a lot of my fellow colleagues in the oil and gas industry, you put it in terms of risk management, the oil and gas industry does risk management every single day. And so, you know, if you put it in terms that people can comprehend, as Rich said, you know, what does this mean to the economy? What does this mean for risk management? Taking out an insurance policy, you know, you don't have to be 100% sold on the science, and the science doesn't have to be 100%, you know, the models don't have to be 100% correct. They're going to give you a range of possibilities, and you have to scenario plan. So yeah, I think absolutely we have to put it in terms of economics, risk, and what does this mean for humans and our future.
Let me grab Keith in Farmington, who's been waiting on the phones as well. Go ahead, Keith.
Evan, a very good show, considering it follows the one that was just on NPR. Maybe I don't understand what a carbon tax is, but I'll run a scenario and have your guests respond. Let's say I'm a business owner, and my tax is $10 million, okay? I have to pay $10 million, and I'm just going to pass it on to each of the products I make. So when you buy it, you're going to pay a little bit more for it, okay? Now, I've paid a $10 million tax, passed it on to you. At the end of the year, you're going to get a carbon tax refund divided up what I paid, okay?
You're right.
So what incentive is it for me to stop polluting if I'm passing on the fee and you're going to get your money back, essentially? You're not getting any extra money. Am I missing something on this?
Keith, it's a great question. What I'm going to do is, first thing I'm going to do is read the very short 4-bullet-point list that CNN put out for how this will work. Then Peter Brin will correct me and CNN, and then our guests in studio can respond as well. Because, again, there are some slightly different models of this out there, but they're roughly the same. Let me read from CNN on the specifics on how it would work, and then we'll talk about Keith's question. First, an escalating carbon tax, starting the tax at $40 a ton, with an understanding it would eventually have to be raised to $50 or more to have the desired impact on consumption and emissions. At $40 a ton, the group estimates its carbon tax would raise $300 billion annually. At $40, the tax would add an estimated 36 cents per gallon to gas prices. Then, carbon dividends. All revenue from the new tax would be rebated back to American taxpayers. The plan calls for the Social Security Administration to administer the plan and estimates the typical family of four would receive from it $2,000 a year. Conservative critics of the carbon tax, including the Koch brothers organizations, have criticized carbon tax proposals as unfair to working families. The dividend idea is the new plan, and the new plan is designed to address that and to keep the proposal neutral from a government revenue perspective. Then a border adjustment fee, high carbon imports would be subject to a tariff adjustment similar to the proposal that House Republicans are considering as part of their border tax reform proposal. And finally, the regulatory rollout. The plan calls for the repeal of the Obama administration's Clean Power Plan and a host of other EPA regulations aimed at reducing carbon emissions. And to make this politically palatable, the authors call for an initial carbon tax rate high enough to guarantee emissions reductions that exceed those forced by the current regulations that would be repealed. So that's the general structure. So, Peter, what I want you to do, if you could jump in, tell me about, you know, your thoughts on how that structure works. And then in relation to Keith's question saying, well, but businesses will just keep, you know, charging more, and how is it going to change any habits there? Go ahead, Peter.
Yeah, so Keith asked a great question. It comes up a lot. So at first glance, it seems, what's the point if you're going to get the money back? Here's the reason it works. The carbon fee is, as you mentioned, there's three parts. One is put a carbon fee, two is return all the refunds to household, and three is do a border adjustment to protect American American production and not send jobs and emissions overseas. So one, two, three, carbon fee, revenue neutral, border adjustment. So the carbon fee, let's take them piece by piece. The carbon fee is exactly proportional to the amount of emissions that your activities are going to put out, right? So you therefore have a clear market incentive to say, this activity is going to cost more in the future. I want to do less of that. I want to either fuel switch or do carbon capture and sequestration or do whatever I have to do to avoid that fee or just become more efficient, right? So there's a clear market incentive. The one place where Keith, I think, was maybe assuming something different than what's being proposed is in the second part, which is the refund. The refund is equally split to every household in the country. As Citizens Climate Lobby proposes it, I think the Climate Leadership Caucus Council has a similar proposal. The way we propose it is an even split to every household in the country. So regardless of what your activities are day in, day out, regardless of what your spending habits are, you're getting this check back. Donald Trump, Bill Gates, and you and I are all getting the same check. It's not means tested, and it has nothing to do with your carbon footprint. It's equally split. So you get that check either way, but the carbon fee is avoidable. If you want to avoid that carbon fee, you choose activities that emit less carbon, and the way that you do that is do what you always did, which is go for the lowest cost products, which is what we always do, right? If you got two cups and one costs $5 and one costs $3 and they otherwise look the same, well, I'm going to go with the $3 one to save a couple of dollars. And embedded in that $5 cost of the more expensive one is probably a higher carbon footprint because that manufacturer didn't choose to innovate yet and reduce his or her emissions. So the incentive to reduce is always there, where the invisible hand of the market then begins to go to work and weed out carbon emissions in the most cost-effective ways possible. But to the point that was made in the article there, the dividend return then not only makes it revenue neutral, it also then protects those low and middle-income households. We've had it modeled, and it appears that about two-thirds, per the estimate from the CLC, 70% of households come out ahead or break even in this plan, meaning that their carbon footprint is below the average. So their cost of living will go up, say, let's just pick a number, say $50 a month, but they're going to get a check back for $100 a month. So there's actually a huge part of the economy that comes out ahead, and they tend to be low and middle income families.
Rob Levine, what would you say to Keith and his concerns there?
Yeah, I agree. The fee is levied at the well and at the source of the carbon. One of the differences between CCL's plan and the CLC plan is that they're only going to talk about carbon at this point, and methane, as we know, is a much greater cause of global warming. So we need to approach and put a fee on all of these. But if 70% of families are estimated to come out ahead financially, then you want to be part of that group. You're going to have incentive to buy the Prius or the Volt rather than to buy a gas-guzzling car. And those are the things that we need to do to reduce carbon emissions and to make an economic system that's viable for the future.
All right, Chris Stearman, what do you think?
I I think it's a good question, too. And I think about things simply. And as far as I understand it, it just means that basically people are going to be spending or are going to be looking at what they spend their money on. And if they buy things that are more environmentally sound, they're going to be spending much less money and have more money in their pocket.
Here's an email from Margaret, though, that has some concern about families that might not come out ahead. And let me go ahead and read this, and we'll get our panelists to respond here. She says, what amount would the dividend be per person at the start? In general, I support both the CCL and the CLC plans, but I am concerned that many people in upstate New York would have their gasoline and home heating costs rise more than they would get back as a dividend. The statistics that poor people spend less on fossil fuels is aggregated, and the numbers are skewed by the large numbers of people with low incomes who live in major cities with excellent public transport. But low and moderate income people who live in rural areas don't have many options for reducing their use of fossil fuels. The more rural you get, the less expensive housing gets, but public transport also becomes less of an option. Plus, you have to have money to save money. Electric and hybrid cars are expensive initially. Both old farmhouses are drafty and very expensive to insulate and make airtight. Older manufactured homes are also very inefficient and hard to weatherize. That's from Margaret. Peter Brin, what would you say to Margaret?
I'd say, Margaret, that's a great question. That's one of the most common ones that our members of Congress ask often. And because we got that question so often, Citizens Climate Lobby, looking at our carbon fee and dividend proposal, we had a study done that was trying to really get at the heart of that issue. We call it the Household Impact Study. And what it does is it looks down to, we have state reports and congressional district reports, which literally look at a member of Congress's own district and their constituents and break out how many households break even, how many come out ahead, how many are what we call minimally impacted, which is that their cost of living is estimated to go up about 0.2% of their annual income. So it's a very modest increase. And the short answer is, the interesting thing, that question about what about rural households that are, you know, sort of out there and you have to drive 30 minutes to get to the grocery store and all that. And even for a lot of those folks, we find that a lot of those folks come out ahead. And part of the reason for that is that if you look at somebody's average carbon footprint, you know, it's a really hard thing to calculate. I've never even tried to bother calculating it because it's one of these really, you know, kind of opaque things to calculate. And that's why we like the carbon fee, because if you apply it upstream, that cost just trickles itself down throughout the economy, and you don't have to worry about what your carbon footprint is. You just go to the store and you just buy stuff like you always did. But what we found is that if you estimate this, about a pretty significant portion, I want to say about two-thirds, if I remember correctly, of somebody's carbon footprint is not turning on the lights and starting up your car, even in those rural households. It's the stuff that you buy. It's all the indirect carbon footprint. And so because of that, your gas prices are going to go up a little bit when you go fill up at the pump, but it's actually the stuff that we buy and it's industry that will also have this price signal. Rob and Chris might have a better understanding of the impacts for New York than I do from the household impact study, so I'll defer to them. But, that's a great question. It comes up a lot, and the good news is that rural low-income households generally are in that same bucket of folks that break even or come out ahead.
All right, Chris. Well, there's plenty of rural people in Congressional District number 27, right? It's kind of a mix, I would assume. I haven't looked at the map in a little while, but what would you say to people in rural areas who have that same concern, saying, you know what, I'm concerned about the climate, but is this going to hit me harder, and what should I do about that?
Well, I don't have the study results in front of me either, but I remember looking to see what did it look like for New York and the rural areas of New York, and overall, I think that even though we don't have public transportation, it still will benefit households more than it will cost them, and it is going to be more towards what people are purchasing, and it's not just fuel, and then it's going to lead people to buy. Eventually, down the road, cars and things that are more gas efficient, and farming. There's all kinds of options for saving money with how you do your farming.
Okay, Rob Levine.
Yeah, I don't think there's the regional economic modeling Inc. study that was done several years ago suggested the same thing, that 70% of households, regardless of what that fee actually is. Are going to come out ahead. And one of the important things on the program for both of these propositions, is that the fee starts out at a certain level and it increases steadily but measurably over a period of time. So you as a consumer will know that prices are going to go up in a certain way over a certain period of time, and you're going to base your purchasing decisions on that. So there's going to be real incentive for people to get the better insulation for their home or whatever it will be, and using the dividend that they're receiving to offset that, is proven. We'll hope it'll be proven down the road. But the models show that will really be a success in spurring economic growth because of the change of consumer habits.
All right, listeners, we're going to come back to your phone calls and questions and comments. We're also going to address a question I got via email, which is how I can get involved, how you can get involved. Rob and Chris are two people who have given their time after learning more about these issues and saying, what can I do? So if you've got those same kind of questions, we're going to answer those coming up here. We'll let you know where you can get online and find out more about the fee and dividend, which does seem to be the kind of plan that could gain the most momentum in today's political climate as we deal with climate change. Our only break of the hour is revenue neutral with no carbon footprint. And we're right back on Connections. Coming up in our second hour, we preview the 2017 Rock Awards. Sunday is the ceremony, and it's a ceremony that honors, a lot of different people in our community, but artists, musicians, performers, who maybe you haven't heard of or maybe you know a little bit about, the kind of talent that might have national aspirations but hasn't really gotten the recognition it deserves, the Rock Awards, in the spotlight next hour. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. The headline that brought us to this hour was James Baker and a number of prominent Republicans, kind of elder Republicans, Republicans with a track record, a history, serving the government at various levels, former cabinet secretaries, a group of them getting together, going to Washington last week and telling members of Congress and the White House, look, you've got the White House, you've got Congress, you've got a chance to do something about climate change, and you should, and here's a plan that you can use that would be more market-friendly, that would be more conservative in many ways in terms of their view on fiscal policy. And we're going to see if it has any sticking power with current office holders. That's been the hard question. On the line with us is Peter Brin, who is the conservative director of the Citizens Climate Lobby. He's an engineer. He began his career with ExxonMobil, joining us from Houston. And Rob Levine and Chris Stearman are with the the Citizens Climate Lobby. There's all these great
organizations. We all work together.
Yeah, that's right. And here they are in studio with me. I want to get back to your phone calls and Jane in Rochester next. Go ahead, Jane. Hi, Jane. Are you there?
Yeah, I'm there. I'm here. Can you hear me?
I can. Go ahead.
Okay, good. It seems to me that if the interest is really in providing a disincentive for production, that we would just say it's against the law to hide your wealth in the Cayman Islands and other such things, if you really wanted if that was the interest. But what I feel here in my gut is a shell game and smoke and mirrors, and I think the primary focus is on that free market religion. And of course, these people are out of Texas, out of Houston and Exxon. Evan, please. What I believe they're really after is to deregulate of things like the standards for clean air and water. That's the prize, I believe, that they're they're really after. And they're just on the Trump bandwagon. They probably love Trump. But I want to say one other thing. I think that all of this hoopla about carbon tax is just a distraction. Even if you got it, it could be revoked at any time. These companies are the wealthiest in the world. They are the dirtiest, and they do the least for us. As they say, ethics is no problem for them. But I feel like this is all a distraction, and they're just opportunistic to deregulate, like I said, even things like clean air and water, which they cry about all the time. And I wouldn't buy a used car from them. Thank you.
Jane, thank you for that. Tough remarks. And I'm going to kick it to Peter Brin in just a second here. But let me also say, Jane, I understand some of the complaints that we're getting in various forms, Twitter and email, saying, who cares if it's market friendly? This is a climate emergency, and we need to act now regardless. And I understand that sentiment. But I also understand the political pragmatism here that says, if you want to pass meaningful regulation, you have to understand what motivates people in different political parties, people with different values, people from different parts of the country. And Jane, I don't know Bob Inglis personally. He's been on this program. I don't know Peter Brin. It's my first conversation with him. I've never met James Baker, but I don't get the sense that they are all sort of in the bag for Trump. Though, Peter Brin, this is your chance to tell us if you're just in the bag for Trump. Go ahead.
Well, of course, I try to see the best in everybody, so I'm optimistic that President Trump will sign our bill into law, but that's yet to be seen. I'm behind this plan because of ideology and because of pragmatism. Ideologically, I think that while I don't think the free market is the answer to every solution, I do think that it is a very effective answer when it can be put to work, for social good in this case. And so I do believe that a market-based solution will work. But I'm also, as you mentioned, Evan, I'm also a pragmatist. We need to get, let me put it this way. One of the quotes that I like from Bob Inglis is, he says, if you're a progressive, behold in conservatives your indispensable partner for action. It will not happen without them. If we look at the makeup of the current Congress and the White House, a solution that does not have some appeal to the right is probably dead on arrival. A solution that does have appeal on the right is hard enough. Let's put it that way. I mean, as evidenced by all the work that we're doing as peers through Citizens Climate Lobby. A couple of points that Jane raised, though, that I do want to respond to specifically. First is revoking EPA's authority on clean air, clean water. Let's be very clear. The EPA was founded in large part to enforce the Clean Air and Clean Water Act, and the importance of those cannot be understated. And that is not what at least anybody. First of all, Citizens Climate Lobby is not proposing any change to the EPA's authority. The Climate Leadership Council is proposing revoking the EPA's authority to regulate greenhouse gases. That's different than clean air, clean water. So they're not calling for that. That is something separate. second of all, the concern about that Jane raised, which is a fair one, this can just be revoked if we put a carbon price in place. Well, that's true. But I would actually argue that it is much easier to revoke something like the Clean Power Plan, which is what President Obama put in place, with a changing administration. And we're seeing that right now. One of the reasons that President Trump has nominated Scott Pruitt for the EPA is because he's been a very, very vocal opponent, and he sued the EPA against the Clean Power Plan. The belief by the administration is that that is an overreach of what the Clean Air Act was originally intended to do. So long story short, it is much easier, in my view, to revoke something that is an executive action only as opposed to what we're pursuing, which is a legislative action. And if we're actually able to get this through Congress and pass it on the president's desk and signed, that is a much, much, much more difficult thing to undo, especially, let's be honest, once people start getting their carbon dividends. That's going to be a very popular policy. Their cost of living may go up, but that's going to be much, first of all, it's going to be outweighed by the carbon dividend. Second of all, it's going to be much less obvious to people that their cost of living has gone up $50 a month than getting a check for $100 a month at the end of the month. So I'm very optimistic about this plan, not only because I think it'll work, but also because I think it has incredible staying power once it's in place.
Okay. Chris Dierman?
So I was just thinking, I'm so glad what Peter Brin just said is that once people are getting a dividend, removing that talk about political suicide. When you see what the dividend that comes from the oil and gas, basically up in Alaska, that's been a huge issue that people don't want to take away from the population up there. So I think that right there is going to be one thing that's going to make it pretty hard to revoke. And then the other part is, how are we going to get anything done if you can't get the other side even to come to the table? We've seen for the past 8 years what that's like. And I'm really excited. Now we actually have something that looks like we could have people from both sides at the table.
Okay. I want to squeeze in as many more listener comments as we can. Robert in Fairport is next. Go ahead, Robert.
Thanks for taking my call. California passed a law last fall that is going to cut methane emissions from livestock by 40% by the year 2030 from levels as recent as 2013. It isn't even clear how this can be done. One way I think it can be done is a lot of California farms are going to go out of business. if we're sort of in the business of regulating carbon emissions from animals, how long is it going to be before we do the same thing for humans?
Robert, thanks for the phone call. Peter, have you heard that concern?
Yeah, I guess my answer would be that's not included in our plan. We don't include agriculture, and no, we're not going to include methane emissions from people. That's just not in the cards. So the short answer is we're not talking about methane specifically in our plan. It's covered, but the challenge with methane, as I think you rightly were getting to, is that it's a very difficult thing to track. I mean, the industry itself, speaking from an oil and gas perspective, and an industry that is challenged with methane emissions, it's a notoriously difficult thing to do. It's an odorless, gas and no color, colorless, and it is emitted in many places for many reasons. And so, it's a very difficult thing to do, as opposed to where you're trying to get carbon CO2 emissions, and in that case, you can simply look at a barrel of oil or a ton of coal, and you know exactly how much CO2 is going to be put out once it's burned. So, in principle, methane emissions are covered, but in practice, that's going to be a much more difficult thing to address. And I'm very sympathetic to the argument that says, let's be careful about how we do this, because no, we don't want farmers in California going out of business, and we also don't want a regulatory framework that is massive to try to figure it out. So that is going to be a challenge, I contend. And again, that's why we really focus on the carbon fee applied to coal, oil, and gas only at this point, because that's the simplest and most market-based way to do it, as opposed to a big regulatory approach that track methane emissions.
All right, Robert, got to keep it tight if you want to follow up. Go ahead.
I just think the problem with these laws is they're not universally applied, so somebody from China or India is not subject to any of these things. It creates an unlevel playing field.
That's a very common concern, and Rob Levine, are you, how do you feel about
well,
that?
Well, the border adjustment is the solution to that,
okay.
And both the Climate Leadership Council and CCL's programs address that. So countries that don't
have...
It's
a fair concern, isn't it?
Oh, it's definitely a fair concern. I spoke to a person who was getting soapstone from India, from Brazil, and was very concerned about the cost of his product for what he did for his carvings. But the border adjustment will hopefully take care of that, so that countries that do have a similar tax as we do have a freer flow of trade, and those that don't will have to pay a tariff. It's not much different from what Trump is proposing on other goods coming into the country. And that should level the playing field so that that's equitable for all.
All right, Robert, thank you. Really smart questions there. John in Pittsburgh, next up, and got to keep it tight. Go ahead, John.
Yeah, hi. I'm not sure if I like this idea, because it's very similar to a fine for polluting for a company. It's much less expensive for them to pay the fine, continue making profits, than it is to change and not pollute. So although a dividend is nice, I would have to say the tax that they're going to have to pay is much less than the profits are going to be making, and the dividend is not going to help the environment to make itself healthy again.
Okay, John, thank you. Peter Brin, what do you think?
That's why we propose that the carbon fee has to start small so you don't shock the economy, but escalate steadily and rapidly over time. The effectiveness of the fee is entirely tied to how high it is. And so, if it gets up to $200 or $300 a ton after a couple of decades, that will send a pretty strong incentive to reduce emissions.
All right, Peter, before we let you go, where would you send people to get more information online to read about this kind of plan and to learn more?
Well, I would love to have my colleagues actually speak to that, since they're up in New York. I mean, anybody can get onto the website, citizensclimatelobby.org. We have a weekly call on Wednesday, but I think maybe Rob and Chris can talk about our footprint in New York.
Yeah, Rob and Chris are great examples of people who've gotten involved. So, Chris, anything you want to send people to online, and what's the brief message for people who are thinking about getting involved in the way you have? How to do it. Go ahead.
Well, the way I learned about it is listening to Connections, so I guess that's
what a great advertisement for this one.
but I think the way I started is I went on to citizensclimatelobby.org,
yep.
And then looked up Rochester, New York, and saw who was involved here and got in contact with the people that are here.
You really accessible?
Emails. Yes, very easy to do.
All right, so piece of cake there. Rob, same question.
Yeah, we have a meeting every third Monday of the month at 7 o'clock at the First Unitarian Church on Winton Road. Our next meeting will be this coming Monday. We've actually set aside an additional half hour starting at 6:30 because we expect such an influx of new people who are interested. And if Citizens Climate Lobby and the carbon fee and dividend is not going to float your boat in terms of getting involved, the Rochester People's Climate Coalition has a website, and there are a multitude of ways to get involved in becoming a climate activist.
All right, so there's a lot out there, and I just want to thank both Rob and Chris for coming in. Our phone continues to ring. We could have done several hours
on this.
I'll stay. I'll tell you what, we've got a lot more to talk about soon on this because we will follow the progress of this, and I hope you'll come back soon. Chris, Rob, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Evan.
Peter Brin from the Citizens Climate Lobby taking the whole hour for us. You're generous with your time, Peter, and I hope to talk to you again.
Oh, thank you very much. Appreciate it.
And listeners, again, a lot to learn, but I think this was a very informative hour about an approach that, you know, who knows? The political climate is tough to get a whole lot of done on a lot of different issues, but this might be the one that's got the most traction, so we shall see. Short break. More Connections next.